It's a great pleasure to be part of this seminar series and to have the invitation to come to Canada, which is actually one of my favorite places to visit, even when it's been very, very cold. Now, Hans and I have been working in the problem that I'm going to be describing to you over the past 4 years. So I know that the usual ordering of seminars in this series is to have the optimization specialist go first and then the application, but we figured that it would probably be better to do things this way, in which I would give you a context for the problem that we're solving and what we're trying to do, and then Hans will, as part of his talk, fill in the details in terms of the optimization problems and how they're solved numerically. And as I mentioned, as you can see from the title, I'm going to be speaking about plant-friendly system identification and how meaningful it is for the process industries. So assuming that there probably isn't very much familiarity with what system identification is, I will spend the first part of my talk describing the problem of system identification and then be more specific of what it means to be plant-friendly. And I guess the short definition, it is that being plant-friendly is the opposite of being plant-hostile, which is what the theory usually requires when you try to get models out of data. And my explanation of identification testing and how we design these input signals that allow us to get models or data that we can use to get models for control, I will focus then on the basically what's been the bulk of our activity, which is to design a particular class of signals, multi-sign signals, which can be introduced into process systems, and where we've used optimization, state-of-the-art optimization tools, in a very effective manner. And I will be illustrating that with a benchmark type process operation, which is high period distillation. Okay, so this is essentially the third topic will you know, be the central focus of the talk. And then I'll try to wrap up by talking about this problem that we call identification test monitoring, which is an extension of the ideas, something that we've been contemplating on doing, and then have some summary and conclusions. Now, system identification, it's interesting because the term system identification was coined by Lofty Sade, who's, I guess, the father of the field of fuzzy logic back in the early 60s. And as you can read from the definition here, it talks about determining on the basis of input and output a system from a class of systems. But in effect, what system identification is a field that is interested in understanding how you can get a dynamical model of a system from input and output measurements. Okay? And the reasons why in industry a topic like this is so important is that, sure enough, in an engineering curriculum, we teach our students how to model systems dynamically based on first principles. But when you start entering into the complexity that you see in a real industrial situation, you find that you need to get those models empirically from data. So in system identification, we're interested in understanding or coming up with techniques that if we are able to measure the outputs of the system, which we can through sensors, and then we can design through particular inputs and implement them through actuators to get certain outputs, we can then come up with the system of differential equations that describes the dynamics of the system. And for purposes of my talk, I will focus on getting ordinary differential equations that are used for control systems. This is a very vast field, and pretty much any kind of model that you can think of, there's some associated system identification problem related to it. Now, one aspect that I'm going to bring up here at the very beginning is that what makes this problem very challenging in practice is that you have disturbances. And you have signals that come in and affect your outputs independent of your inputs. So a big issue in system identification is how do we deal with these disturbances. And that's where, as you will see in a few minutes, the theory tends to be plant hostile when it comes to conditions for guaranteeing asymptotic convergence of estimates and parameter estimation. Now, system identification as a field is really broadly applicable and is not exclusive to the problem of control system design, but it turns out that control system engineers, people who are interested in taking these models to build control algorithms, tend to be the most interested in the problem. In fact, the International Federation for Automatic Control, acronym for it is IFAC, has a series of workshops that they sponsor, and then they have a World Congress that they hold every 3 years. And aside from the World Congress, which brings together all the different areas, the IFAC workshop that has the greatest attendance is the one on system identification. And in fact, it's occurring, the one for 2006 is occurring at the end of this month in Newcastle, Australia. Okay. And so again, control engineers are very much interested in this problem. And when it comes to actually implementing control systems in industry, and for my case, and as Henry mentioned, my background is in chemical engineering, and I used to work in the refining industry. In this industry, being able to do the modeling required for control systems is often the most time-consuming and expensive portion of the entire life cycle of going from an uncontrolled system to a controlled one. So these are the basic five steps in system identification. First step is you design an experiment that's informative. You do so on the plant. The plant is usually making money. They don't stop operation just for doing your test. So it's usually superimposed over operations. And you want to do that test in a manner that gives you informative data in the shortest period of time possible. Because in effect, the people in the plant want you to get done with the testing business so they can go on to making the product. Okay. And this is the step that I will focus on the most in this talk. Once you get your data, you have to pre-process it and get rid of outliers. Usually you want to make the time series stationary, that kind of thing. Then you have to pose some kind of model structure. Probably the most common system identification techniques are based on linear regression models, and they're referred to as prediction error models. So you pick some kind of a model structure based on the prediction error model family, and then there's some parameter estimation step, which in the most ubiquitous of cases ends up being some kind of either linear or nonlinear regression problem. And then, of course, you have to check the model to make sure that it's appropriate for there's different kinds of validation tests. The classical validation test is that you look at the residuals and you want to make sure that your residuals are white or correspond to white noise, which would then mean that you've modeled everything that can be modeled about your system. You can have other kinds of validation techniques where the question that you want to answer is, have I obtained a model that meets my end use? Okay. But in effect, these are the five steps of system ID. And an important aspect to recognize about the system ID task is that this is normally an iterative procedure. And in fact, that's really something that's somewhat inherent to modeling in the real world, is that you sort of have to iterate between the different steps. As you gain more a priori knowledge, you're able to refine on the different steps. So this is a picture here that comes from a book by Jung and Glad. Leonard Jung is a professor of electrical engineering at Linköping University in Sweden. And he's written a seminal book, a couple of books on the field, and this particular one, Jung and Glad, is one that's geared for undergraduates. And he's also written, there's a system identification toolbox in MATLAB that he's authored. So he's really an authority in the field. I had the pleasure of doing a sabbatical there in 1996, so I can refer to him as a friend, which is nice. Well, in Jung and Glad's book, he shows this this general algorithm here, or a flowchart. And what I want you to keep in mind is, you see the different steps that I mentioned in terms of doing the experiment, pre-processing, choosing a model structure, and that kind of thing. But then there's certain levels of iteration. One of them is that we can iterate in terms of model structure. We can pick more or less parameters to iterate on, and that's usually not a bad thing to do once you have a set of data. You can also iterate on the pre-processing. If somehow you didn't make, if you're doing some kind of filtering to emphasize certain frequency regimes, that kind of thing, you can do that on a set of data. But clearly, the most undesirable set of or iteration is going back and redoing the experiment. And oftentimes, you find yourself having to go back and do this and redo the experiment. But since the experiment testing is expensive, it's invasive on the process, it disrupts operations, et cetera, there's really a lot of incentive to keeping these outer iterations to a minimum. you know, in having a good informative data set, because these other iterations that involve already an informative data set, you can pretty much do with a good computer-aided design tool and, you know, and take care of that in a much simpler manner. Now, this is a picture here of the same idea. This comes from Peter Lynchcog was a PhD student at Linköping, and in his PhD thesis, he has a picture that shows the different steps. And what I like about this particular way of representing things are two items. One of them is that is the importance of a priori knowledge and being able to incorporate that in all the different steps of the identification procedure. So for some of the work that I'm going to show you later on, it's very important for us to use whatever we know about the system in order to get an informative test. And then the second aspect is that at the core of identification is a parameter estimation problem. And of course, you could use a lot of fancy optimization for this, but that's not going to be the focus of our talk. So really, you have all these different components that are part of a parameter estimation problem. And of course, having good data is a very, very important part of this procedure. Now, I'm going to show a couple of industrial examples, and the first one that I'll motivate, and what I want to show you here is how system identification enters into the overall control design problem. And this here is the schematic of a gas oil furnace. It's a kind of process operation that you see in a lot of refining type applications where you have some kind of gas oil stream that needs to be heated before it gets put into a catalytic cracking unit or a reforming unit or some other kind of chemical processing operation. And in here, the control problem would be that you want to keep this temperature of this gas oil at some kind of set point or reference point. And to do so, you're going to adjust fuel flow to do that. You're going to build a control system to do that. And the disturbances that are going to come into play are variations in quality and flow and that kind of thing that could occur from the feed stream. There are many different kinds of disturbances that could enter into the problem, ambient conditions, that kind of thing. But in a control problem related to this kind of process operation, we are going to adjust fuel flow to keep this temperature at spec despite all sorts of interesting disturbances. Now, from a first principle standpoint, we would want to describe this system by using principles of conservation of mass, of energy, that kind of thing. That's what we teach the students. But even for just a single heater like this one, the system equations can get pretty nasty. It can get pretty nonlinear. And we are interested then in how do we come up with experiments that we would allow us to manipulate this fuel flow here so that we can get data on the temperature that allows us to build a model, and then from that model we can then design a control system that meets our control objectives. Okay, so one way to relate to this, because I guess I'm probably, I don't know, are there any other chemical engineers in the crowd? Okay, one behind there, but most of you are not chemical engineers, so I figure let me give you a problem that we can all relate to that would have similar dynamic characteristics to this. And that would be the control problem associated with taking a shower. Okay? And you know, it's interesting because controlling a shower is a difficult problem because of the delays involved. Inherently, the delays cause a fundamental limitation to the feedback control you can accomplish. So usually, you're interested in having adequate temperature and water flow. Those would be your control variables. Your disturbances can be a myriad of things, but there can be inlet water flow variations and temperatures. As a resident of Arizona, one thing you learn when you're a homeowner in Arizona is that you do not schedule your sprinklers in your home to go off at the same time you're taking a shower. You learn that very quickly because that's a disturbance that's quite substantial and it's hard to recover from. And you know, if you ever lived in a dormitory, whatever, people are flushing toilets or you're taking a shower. So these are, again, just some candidate disturbances. And then the manipulated variables would be the hot water and cold water valve positions. Okay, so think in terms of this control problem. If you wanted to model this, so you could apply feedback. And in general, in the control problem, what you have is that you have some conditions happening in the open loop before you put in control, where you have variation. In this case, this is an integrated autoregressive type disturbance on the temperature, which is undesirable. And when you put control in, you know, which is seen here at time 2000, the closed loop control, if it's a good controller, what it does is it transfers variability from the control variable to the manipulated variable. Okay? In effect, that's what a good control system does. It transfers variance from expensive resource to a cheaper one. And by doing that, now we have a system that has a lot greater uniformity. Okay? And then once you have this greater uniformity, you can then, through the same control system, take this to a higher or lower set point that optimizes some kind of profit objective or safety objective or something similar. Okay, so if you think, I mean, I'm illustrating this in the context of the shower, but if you think in terms of what's happening with all these computer control systems in a big process system, that's what's going on. The basic control loops and the advanced control loops are trying to transfer this variance so that then you can have higher level decision systems that take you towards desired levels of profitability or safety. Okay. And in what we call engineering control, we always recognize that we have to make these manipulated variable variations to get good control, as opposed to statistical process control, where what you try to do is you try to determine root causes. In statistical process control, you try to determine a root cause for a variation and try to eliminate it. In engineering control, we say, well, we can't get rid of these variabilities, so we just transfer them to places they won't hurt us. Okay, so that's the overall control problem. But to go from here to here, you need to have a good control system. And I think people in industry in general would like to just go from bad open-loop operation to good closed-loop operation in an instant. In practice, you need a model, you need to construct a control system, and if we use the system identification approach, this is more of what you know what happens in real life, or at least what we would like to happen in real life. So we still have our open-loop uncontrolled variation here, then we have an identification test, which involves, in this case, this is a pseudo-random binary sequence. It's one kind of input signal that gets superimposed over. I've written here fuel flow. You can think of the hot water on the shower, whatever helps you understand the concept. Okay, and this input signal is imposed here on the actuator. You get some data from this data. Now you can get a model. That model, dynamical model, allows you then to build a control system. In this case, this is a proportional integral derivative controller, which then gives you the good control. So this is going to be our emphasis, and that has been the emphasis in the work that I've been doing with Hans, is sort of how do we do this experimental test, and how do we get informative data, and how do we do that for challenging multivariable systems. Yes?
Sorry. I'm just not sure what you mean by open
loop. Open loop means that... yeah, sure. Let me go back. Okay. See, in open loop, what I mean is that I am making no adjustments. In other words, if you're thinking in terms of the shower or thinking in terms of the furnace, let me see if the furnace comes back up here. I have a fixed amount of fuel flow coming in, and then because of my disturbance, there's all sorts of variations occurring. So I have not close the loop. Basically, I have not applied any corrective action. So what I'm trying to illustrate there is that in these kinds of problems, in the open loop, that is, without making any adjustments to the manipulated variable, all the disturbances take your controlled variables to regimes and behavior that is undesirable. And then when I do close the loop, which has, and I don't show the block here, but if I actually have the control system reads this measurement, and then there's an algorithm that decides on changes to this. And, I've kept that detail, the controller. That control law then closes the loop, and that then transfers the variance.
I think the reason is this word is shown in a loop that shows in a diagram. Mm-hmm. And the diagram, so to speak, has an open loop before you put the controller in, which kind of closes the loop. So that's why it's very natural.
Yeah, so I mean, there's the inherent process dynamics. And then the controller is an additional set of differential algebraic equations that make decisions, and they're not represented here. And but that's what's making this transfer variability occur. But our focus though is on doing the identification test, which in this case is illustrated in the open loop. And we could do closed loop ID as well, but in this case we are making these changes so that we can get the data that will allow us to get the models that will allow us to close the loop. So that's the focus of this talk. And So now that we've talked about identification testing, and hopefully I've convinced you that this is something that's important and that's a critical component of the overall identification procedure, let's talk about plant-friendly identification testing. And actually the term was coined by individuals at DuPont in the early 90s. But what's interesting here is that, I worked for Shell Development in the late 80s, and we were worried about the same thing, so we never used the term plant-friendly. But we had the same kinds of concerns. And the idea here is that, well, how do we then, if we know that we're making these tests on the process while it's out there in normal operations and it's supposed to be making money and for the company, how do we then design a test that's informative while still meeting these practical requirements, you know, and we would like in general to make it as short as possible. We'd like to be able to be within constraints, and we'd like to keep the disruption on the control variables low, because the control variables are usually associated with our product, and you know, which we want to sell. Now, I made a point earlier that that if you look at theoretical requirements from system identification, they are plant hostile as opposed to plant friendly. And here I'm only going to focus on one point, or because if I were to, you know, give you an identification tutorial, a more general one, I would describe these conditions for getting these asymptotic conditions for getting unbiased estimates or consistent estimation, as it's referred to in identification. And here what I'm just going to show you is the formula relating to reducing variance effects. If you have a model and you want to keep the parameter variance low, what the and this is again a theory for linear models, but and conceptually it extends to nonlinear problems as well. To keep parameter variance low in your model, what you want to do is you want to make the length of your test as long as possible. You know, and take it to infinity if you can, but you can't in real life. You have to make it a finite duration test. And also, the variance of the input signal should also be as high as possible. Okay, both of these things will take the parameter variance down to zero. So one way of thinking about it is, remember, you got your process system, and you've got some disturbances hitting it, and what you really would like to do with that manipulated variable is make it as large as possible so that the signal component of that predominates, and then run it as long as you can. And clearly we cannot do that we cannot have an infinite test, and we cannot have a test with an infinitely large size magnitude. We have to work within certain limits. So plant friendliness relates to how do we keep, you know, everything within acceptable bounds while still getting the information necessary to get a good model. Okay. Now, I've alluded to the fact that this is important for industry, and let me give you some additional examples related to that. So this is from, you know, some years ago. I was doing some consulting with Mitsubishi Chemicals, and they actually provided me with this information from a vendor. I won't name the vendor, but for an ethylene fractionator, which involves 17 independent variables, their guidelines involve a month of testing on the unit. That's a long time. Basically doing different tests on the 17 different manipulated variables to get informative data for identification. This is Air Products and Chemicals. They presented a series of papers. One was at the AICHE is the American Institute of Chemical Engineers meeting, and for a large separation unit, talking about 2 months of testing. And then there's another reference I have here, which is from another paper presented at the American Institute of Chemical Engineers annual meeting, where these individuals talk about step testing. Step testing is also referred to as bump testing. It's probably one of the simplest forms of identification testing, where all you do is you just do a step change in each one of the manipulated variables. And here they cite that for a typical process system, it would cost around $300,000. And you can see that this would involve in both loss of product in the quantity of product, product being off spec, engineering time, that kind of thing. Okay, so this clearly a lot of incentive to being able to keep these tests you know, within these plant-friendly type constraints. And then the last point that I make here, and here I only, for the purposes of this particular talk, I'm only going to address one of the topics, is that there is a theory out there on optimal input signal design that's basically come from the electrical engineering controls type of mindset. And two things are important. One of them is that to design the optimal input test, you need to know the model. And there's a conundrum there because the reason why you're doing the identification test is to get the model. So, but if you look at the classical input signal design literature, it will require that you know what the system model is and what the noise characteristics are. And then the second point I want to emphasize, and this has been critical in terms of the work that we've done and the formulation that we've used in our work, is that for a process control engineer, they tend to think more in terms of having, rather than thinking about minimizing some kind of norm criteria, when thinking in terms of an identification test, we want to make sure that it's within certain constraints, that the changes in the manipulated variables are within certain limits, that the changes in the outputs are within certain limits. And we have not seen constraint formulations for these kinds of problems. So, you know, when you know, Hans and I started talking about working on this, that was one of the and being able to use advanced optimization methods, that was one of the incentives that we could solve these problems while specifying the kind of time domain constraints that a process engineer would tend to think of. Okay, so this will be, this case study here will be the basis for the remaining results that that we presented in my talk. And what we have here is a binary distillation column. I'll explain, I'll give you a general description of what distillation is all about. In distillation, what you have is you have a mixture, a feed stream that comes into your column. It's a stage separation device, that's how we refer to it. And the mixture, the individual components of the mixture have different boiling points. So what you do in a distillation column is you apply heat at the bottom of the column, and then you condense the stuff in the top, and by having a heat gradient in the column and using that difference in boiling points, you end up having a stream that is basically, essentially, rich in the lighter component on the top, or the distillate stream, and then is then rich in the heavier component in the bottom stream. And you know, in a typical chemical engineering course, we teach students how to design these distillation columns. And in fact, if you drive by any refinery, there's a lot of refining petrochemical facilities in Canada. Energy sector is very big here. You can see these columns as you drive by. And I'm pretty sure you've all seen a column, even if you haven't recognized it as such. So in high purity distillation, here's the essential challenge, is that it's very difficult in high purity distillation to control the system so that you get high purity in both distillate and bottom streams. These systems are referred to as highly interactive or strongly interactive because the based on the first principles models that describe it, on the, and the fundamental physics of the problem, the tendency in these columns is that if you want to get higher purity in the distillate, that occurs only at the expense of worse purity in the bottom. You know, so one direction is predominant, but if you want to have independently control the purity on distillate and bottom, that's going to be difficult. And the way in which this can be visualized best is by doing a state space plot, where in this case here, what we show is for a typical column, Y1 would be the composition on the bottom, Y2 is the composition on the distillate, and you can see that when you put in, and in this particular problem, I should mention that our manipulated variables are the reflux flow and then the boil-up flow. So when you put in what are independent signals for the reflux and the boil-up, you still get this tendency to go in a principal direction. And what you'd like to do for these multivariable strongly interactive systems is that you really want to cover both, not just the high gain direction, but also the low gain direction. And just putting in, you know, random inputs into these signals is not going to accomplish that. You have to use a more clever input design. In fact, I should have mentioned that before, that from the standpoint of classical identification theory for linear systems, the optimal input to put in is white noise. Because white noise in system identification is like white light. It has all the frequencies of the spectrum, and in effect, when you put in white noise, you're able to see both fast and slow dynamics in the system. You have a question? Oh, can you put these? Yeah, can you put them in sequence? Yes, you can do that. Yeah, sure. I mean, you can have trains of these distillation columns and that kind of thing. Yes. But for purposes of this study, I'm just going to focus on a single one. Am I answering your question? Okay. And in this particular column that I'm going to talk about in more detail is the Weishedo-McAvoy column, which is a methanol isopropanol. Now, the class of signals that we're going to consider are multi-sign inputs, which is, as the term indicates, they're just a sum of sinusoids. And what's nice about these particular signals is that we can directly specify the frequency domain characteristics of them. We can specify through the choice of these alphas and the deltas and the A's here, we can specify the power spectral density, you know, how the signal looks in the frequency domain. Again, think in terms of the analogy of white noise and white light, that kind of thing. We want to cover a certain amount of frequencies in our signal so that we see a desired level of excitation. And what we had done in the work, prior to working with Hans, is that we had come up with a scheme for designing these inputs for a multivariable system, and we call that a zippered spectrum. Okay, so in this case, what we do is we need enough sinusoids to correspond to the order of the system. So we know we have a 10th order system, described by the 10th order differential equation. We need at least 10 sinusoids. And then what we do so that we can introduce these multi-signs simultaneously into the system is that we keep them in separate grids. And that's where the zippering comes in. So that way we maintain orthogonality of the signals, and they can be introduced simultaneously into the process, and we can take that data and get a simultaneous model. Okay. And again, I'm not going here, I'm just giving you a very general overview, but we had a scheme for being able to come up with the design of the spectrum, and it's something we developed in our lab over a number of years. Now, for these highly interactive systems, it turns out that in order to be able to get that low-gain information, we introduce these correlated harmonics. And what these correlated harmonics do is they allow us to look at the low-gain direction, and we have a design procedure for doing that. But the important thing to keep in mind here is that it doesn't matter what the spectrum, regardless of how we pick the power spectral density, we're still interested in knowing how this is going to look in the time domain. And the time domain characteristics of the signals are going to be determined by the phases. Okay, so we need metrics to tell us, well, now that we have a signal with the desired frequency content that excites the bandwidth of interest, you know, how do we then get these signals in the time domain to be friendly, to meet these requirements that we mentioned before? And one metric that we use is a crest factor, which is the ratio of the infinity norm to the 2 norm. And basically what the crest factor tells us, the crest factor, the lowest value you can have for crest factor is 1, and then the highest is infinity. And the crest factor equal to 1 means that your signal is evenly distributed between the maximum and minimum values. Okay. Now, we're interested in designing both input and output signals, or getting input and output signals from our experiments that have desirable crest factors, because that's going to lead to basically getting all the information we want from our system with the minimum amount of deviation. Let me try to illustrate this a little bit better. These are two signals. Two signals you see here are two cycles of a single channel multi-sign. So it's for just one actuator. Both signals have identical power spectral densities. So in the frequency domain, they look the same. What's different about them is the phases, and in one case, the phases are all zero. In this other case here, the phases are picked by this formula called the Schroeder phasing, which is a result from the early 70s. And as you can see here, the Schroeder phase signal, which has a lower crest factor, okay, is much better distributed than the one that has just phases equal to zero. I mean, this signal is clearly not plant-friendly because it's... you don't need to have these large deviations to obtain the same level of power. So minimizing crest factor is important, and we, you know, wanted to go ahead and then solve problems that would do so. Now, the challenge with minimizing crest factor, though, as an optimization problem, is that the crest factor is a nonlinear objective, it's non-smooth and non-convex. So here, then, it is important to use sensible optimization schemes. And what had happened in the literature was that there were people who had proposed solutions that had gotten around some of the challenges by using approximations, or they did have formulations that did not include constraints. So these were all things that were important to us. And, you know, once Hans and I started talking about these problems, it was clear that the kind of work that he does and his exposure to the methods and techniques that he's worked on over the years would be useful for this class of problems. Okay? So I'll show you a couple of the optimization problems that we solved. And here they're just sort of written very generally, what we have is we have a power spectrum that's defined a priori, that's either modified or it's zippered in some way, but we have tuning rules or guidelines for doing that. And then what we want to do is we want to then pick the phases so that we minimize crest factor. Okay, and we do so with constraints on the move size. The move size is the rate of change on the manipulated variables and high and low limits. Let me mention while I'm at it that on these problems too, let me show them the spectrum here. We have a desired band that we know we want to have emphasis on, and then we also allow the optimizer to pick harmonics on either low or high frequency. This is what's called the snow effect, and that's part of the problem formulation as well. Okay. So this is one optimization problem that's of interest to us. Probably a more interesting problem formulation is the second one you see here, where now we're interested in minimizing the worst-case crest factor on the output signals, and we want to do so under constraints. Now, for this problem statement to be complete, we need some kind of a priori model. So we have solved these problems by, again, posing some kind of a priori model, because in classical optimal input design literature, people have done the same kind of thing. And when I talk about the end of the talk about identification test monitoring, our goal is going to be how do we deal with that issue that we need some kind of model up front. And then there's other formulations we can do. We can combine both input and output crest factor. We've done that. We've also done optimization problems that involve putting a control system, so doing it in the closed loop. And then there's also problems that we solve using basically designs that lead to uniform distributions in the state space. This involves geometric discrepancy criteria, and Hans in his talk will address that this third item. I won't talk at all. I will give a result at the end to show it very generally, but Hans will discuss that particular problem in more detail in his talk. And Hans will also talk about more details about the solution approach. It's in an ample, so you get automatic differentiation. The crest factor objective can be moved into the constraints, which is, I think, a standard kind of approach done in these kinds of problems. And Hans, again, has used many different methods that he will describe, but these results are based on using the Nitro software and the interior point approach. Of Nocidal, whom I think was the previous speaker in the last series. So, and again, Hans will deal with more details related to that. And if you have any detailed questions about the optimization approach, I would suggest you defer to his talk, because he will answer better than I can. Now, the very first problem that we tried to solve, we did some problems with just a single channel, but the very first multivariable problem we tried to solve was the simplest, most interesting problem we could find. You know, the simplest problem that still had complexity to it. And that comes from this is written in Laplace transforms. This problem is, a binary, a linear approximation of a binary distillation column. It has a condition number of about 140, which is not bad numerically, but it's bad when it comes to control issues. And what we did here is we tried both of the problem formulations that I mentioned before. Here's the two different kinds of spectra, which we design a priori using our guidelines. And then we went ahead and and use the optimization techniques I mentioned earlier to get the different signals. Here the signals are shown. These are, in this case, this is reflux. This is boil up. These are the compositions. And probably, I'm showing you the time series, but the most interesting thing to look at is the state space. Because this is, remember what I said before, in a traditional type design, you get a high gain direction, and you don't see a lot of low gain direction. And this is what you get when you have a standard type spectrum. Then when you make the spectrum modified, then that gives you the green dots that you see here. And so you get a nice, now you get both high and low gain direction. But what we wanted to do is we wanted to get a nice minimum crest factor signal with constraint enforcement. So the nicest result is the blue result here, where now you can see that both there's both high gain direction, low gain direction, and everything conforms to constraints. Okay, so these first set of results, and we tried different types of formulations, and we were very excited as we would get these results. In fact, we, myself and the student involved, I hope you don't mind Hans, but we used to refer to him as Christmas Hans, because it was like every time we meet with him, he'd have a nice result for us, and it was like a Christmas present. So, because people had told us, the interesting thing is we had mentioned this to individuals before, and they had told us that this couldn't be done. And in our case, you know, the enabler was the optimization tools. So that again, that's a linear problem, and you know, we get good proof of concept. What we really want to do is work with a simulation of a real life system that has all the complexities. So now the results are going to show are with the Weishedo McAvoy column, which is nonlinear, highly interactive. It has 27 trays in it, so it's a relatively high order system. And see how we could get these ideas to work. So here we show, the red just shows the standard type of design, and then the blue here shows our corresponding signals using our approach. So we see, you can see that you get the high gain direction and the low gain direction. In order to do so, the input signal has to be very correlated in order to be able to give you that low gain information. And when we started working with this nonlinear column, we were using as our a priori model a so-called ARX model, which is basically a regression model. ARX stands for autoregressive with external input. It's just a linear regression model. And here, our concern when we started then working with the nonlinear column model was that with the linear model, we get good predictions that are within constraints, but when we then take it to the nonlinear system, we have basically mismatch between the models. And we have to address that because we would, in effect, constraints that we would think we would satisfy based on the design of the signals would not occur on the more complicated simulation. So one of the nice things about the optimization approach is that we could include a nonlinear model in our optimization problem. We could readily do so. I mean, it represents a more challenging optimization problem numerically, but conceptually, there was nothing that kept us from including the a nonlinear model. So what we did is we included what's called the NARX model, which is a nonlinear ARX model, which is a type of a black box nonlinear model. And we're able to incorporate this now in the problem formulation as a way of being able to predict outputs. And then what I want you to be able to see in this case now is that using the NARX model, there's very little mismatch between what happens in the complicated simulation and what we got in our design. So this distortion that we had before is now sort of reduced, and you can see that you get the nice directionality in terms of high gain direction, low gain direction. Okay, and then these models we then take and get a model that we can then design control systems on. And in fact, that part I'm just going to gloss over. We use what's called model predictive control, which is actually based on real-time optimization. And this slide I'm just going to just put it here just briefly, but trust me that we are able to get from these signal designs better models for control of these highly interactive systems. Okay. Now, let me give you a sense for a result that then Hans, or an approach that Hans will describe in more detail. Having had success with with these kinds of crest factor designs, we then were interested in approaching problems where you want to get a uniform distribution on the state space. Because if you look back, I'll go back to the result from here, you can see that even though we have the directionality information, we have all these gaps. Okay. So in my lab, we've been interested in these sort of data-centric estimation approaches, of which one of them is called model on demand. And I guess these type of ideas have relations to data mining in some ways. And so we then decided, well, what would allow us to then do designs that would have a uniform coverage on the state space? Okay. And we've been able to do so, as you can see here on the right, using a whale-based criterion, which Hans will describe in more detail. Now, what I want you to realize from this result here to the right is that we are getting this nice uniform distribution on a system that is highly nonlinear, that tends to go in a principal direction with restrictions on how we design the spectrum to be zippered. So this is not just, you know, getting this uniform distribution of points on a system that tends to go in an opposite different direction is quite an accomplishment, you know, from our standpoint. And we've been able to show that we get good data-centric type control for these kind of systems. In fact, I'm going to the CISID meeting in Newcastle, Australia, the System Identification Symposium, and I'm presenting a paper on this whale-based analysis. Okay, so to conclude the seminar, what I'd like to just address very briefly is all these problem formulations have assumed that we have some kind of model a priori. And what we've been thinking is, well, how do you then, can you, you know, you start out identification not knowing that much about the system. You start putting in these inputs. These inputs are deterministic and periodic, so can you take advantage of that to then learn about your system as, you know, as experimental testing is going on, and then refine your test. And this is what we've called identification test monitoring. So what we do is basically we implement a cycle of the signal and then get some data from those cycles, and then based on the information we get from the first cycles, we refine future cycles to have the information we need. So I have here a diagram, and this just shows it for a problem that has one input and one output, where you can see that we start out with a signal that has a rather wide band spectrum, you know, and it's rather conservative on the magnitude, you know, and because we don't want to upset operations. Based on this first set of data, then we go ahead and refine our spectrum, and that gives us a second signal that we implement. And then from that second cycle, then we come up with a new experimental design. And then this idea of identification test monitoring, it brings up a lot of signal processing issues, identification issues, but it also brings optimization issues in that we sort of have to solve these problems in quasi-real time. You know, and again, these plants tend to be sort of slow because they're large and that kind of thing, and have you know, large capacity plants. But nonetheless, we still have to address that issue of how do we apply these optimization methods and refine these signals along the way. And this is, you know, the ideas that we're you know, contemplating now and you know, pursuing in the future. So in conclusion, I hope I've been able to demonstrate to you that this notion of plant-friendly identification is important in the process industries. I've shown you how we've been able to use optimization-based designs to handle a demanding process system. And hopefully with these ideas of identification test monitoring or things that we study from that, we can come up with ways of being able to practically handle the issue that we don't have a lot of a priori knowledge, but we gain it as we do experimental testing. And let me just then acknowledge, of course, Hans. And Gautam was a student that worked on the whale-based design that Hans will speak about. Hyunjin Lee is a current PhD student. Martin Brown was, in fact, one of the students. He's now working at Intel, but that got Hans and I together. He's the one who said these problems will be right up his alley, or something like that, when we were looking into doing these kinds of designs. And then we have funding for doing this through the American Chemical Society Petroleum Research Fund. And that's pretty much it. If you want to know a little bit more about this work, you can look at our website. A lot of these papers are posted. Okay.